From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and if you're looking to clear some sonic space for yourself, you know, a little peace and quiet in our noisy lives, you might not immediately think punk rock. But the forthcoming exhibit on punk and its impact on the fashion industry will be opening this week at the Metropolitan Museum. So really, how loud can it be? No, that's not from the Met's punk exhibit. This little burst of noise came from Iggy Pop and his reunited band, The Stooges. They did a special live public radio show on Sunday afternoon, and we'll give you a taste of something old and something new from the proto-punk star. And we'll ask what it means for punk when the Met Museum comes calling. Now, if you really want some peace and quiet, you could just listen to Iron and Wine, the band led by Sam Beam. His new album's a bit of a departure. It's full of big arrangements, has a lively 70s soul feel, but in our studio today, it's just Sam Beam, playing that spare solo music that made Iron and Wine such a cult favorite in the first place. And of course, you can find other ways to clear out some of the noise from your life. That's our question of the week this week on Soundcheck, and after all, people have been doing that for years, centuries even, maybe even longer. A recent BBC 4 radio series called Noise, A Human History, has been examining how noise has shaped civilization for the past, 100,000 years. Professor David Hendy is the host and writer of that series, which wrapped up last week, and he joins me now from the BBC studios in Oxford, England. David, welcome.
Thank you.
Not too ambitious, eh? A 100,000-year history of sound.
Yeah, it's fairly ambitious, I suppose, and it's also, many people think, a fool's errand. How do you tell us a history of sound when sound disappears the moment it's born?
And we've only had recording since the 19th century, so how much do we know about the history of noise?
Well, it's certainly true that the further back in time you go, the more you have to make educated guesses. But actually, sound does leave traces. You can go back to, say, the memoirs and the diaries of some of the colonists who, from Europe, settled in North America in the 16th, 17th centuries. And they write very, very vividly. They describe the sound worlds that they found, the sound of Native Americans, the sounds that they were making themselves. So a lot of travellers have always been struck, not just by what they see when they visit new lands, but what they hear.
Now, it's curious, David, to hear you use the word sound as opposed to noise in the last couple of moments. How do you distinguish between sound and noise?
Well, I find it creatively interesting to blur the boundaries a little bit, because it's true that, generally speaking, noise is the equivalent in sound of how we've defined dirt. We've defined dirt as matter out of place. In other words, it doesn't belong there. And noise, in a sense, is a sound that someone somewhere doesn't really like or want to be heard. But of course, it's also subjective. That's not to say that there's no such thing as noise and that all sounds are always lovely. But it's certainly the case that in history, if you just condemn everything as noise, it tends to mean that you're not necessarily listening to it. And it's interesting that the powerful in history have often condemned the weak or the alien or the strange or the unfamiliar, the foreign, as noisy. And, you know, there are examples of that all the way through history, right up to the present day. So I think it's useful to talk about noise and to talk about sound, but we have to really get to grips with why it is that some sounds are described as noise and others aren't.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with David Hendy, Professor of Media and Communication at the University of Sussex in England. He's creator of the 30-part BBC4 radio series, Noise, A Human History. And so how far back can we find evidence of people trying to do what we're talking about this week on Soundcheck, which is to clear a space, to escape from noise?
Well, I suppose one of the clearest early examples is an ancient city that in many ways was the New York of its time, a cultural melting pot of a million people, and that's ancient Rome. In ancient Rome, noise was a problem. It wasn't the first city with a problem of noise, but it was the first major city where noise involved rules and law, and people were writing vividly about it. This was the center of a great empire. Mm-hmm. Goods were constantly arriving, travelers and so on. And a lot of goods were delivered at night. In fact, for many years in the Roman Empire, goods couldn't be delivered during the day. They were always delivered at night. So sleep was a problem. If you were wealthy and if you were part of the Roman elite, you would flee the centre of the city and you would live amongst the imperial class on the Palatine Hill. Yeah. So ancient Rome had it, and then if you follow through the Middle Ages, people with money and power would always be able to, in a sense, insulate themselves from noise through thicker walls or housing further away from the city centres.
That's fascinating. So sound or protection from noise as a kind of status symbol, as a marker of where you were.
It was a marker. And of course, the more that happened, the more that you as a wealthy, powerful person could create an environment of quiet, the more it was that noise itself came to be seen as vulgar.
Right.
So you get into this vicious circle, of you've escaped from sound yourself that irritates you, but you don't actually become more tolerant of it when you go out. You become less and less tolerant of it. It's more and more offensive to your ears.
Soundcheck listeners, that's our question to you this week. How do you block out noise in your day-to-day life? You can't flee to the Palatine Hills, presumably, but where do you go? What do you do to create a quiet space? You can leave us a voicemail, 866-939-1612, or leave a comment on soundcheck.org or tweet us at soundcheck. The number again, 866-939-1612. We're speaking with Professor David Hendy, host and writer of the series Noise, A Human History. There's a companion book coming out here in the States this fall, also called Noise, A Human History of Sound and Listening. What about sounds that are present but perhaps just at the threshold of audibility? I'm thinking here in the States of the 60-cycle hum of electricity, I guess 50 cycles there for you. I mean, it's there. It surrounds us. It's a pervasive part of our life. And yet somehow we sort of walk through this field of sound without even noticing it's there.
We do. And one of the really interesting things about sound is that we have two responses to it. One is hearing it and one is listening to it.
Mm.
We change our mode of response. And I suppose the classic example is background music, for example, which again, a lot of people would regard as an unpleasant and pervasive feature of 20th and 21st century living.
Mm-hmm.
That burble of music that plays in shopping malls and cafes and so on. We are capable of zoning out from that, but we're also capable, recall maybe being in a party where there's a lot of chatter and you're standing next to someone and actually you're listening to someone else who's just to one side. Your ears are able, or of course it's your brain, is able to distinguish between some sounds and other sounds and to zone out of other ones. So we have very clever means of managing sound. And in fact, if we had total silence, it is very, very uncanny and very unsettling. And that's why, for instance, various studies show that what's the perfect environment for, say, creative writing? It's not necessarily a silent monastery or a silent library. It's a cafe with a steady burble of sound. And what people are really after when they say they want silence is really the space to think. Mm-hmm. It's a place where there is a sort of a wallpaper of sound, an emulsion of sound, and that kind of low level, fairly continuous sound actually suits us really well. I think the other thing that I noticed in doing this series, I think, is that when we try to achieve silence, there are two dangers. One is that it involves silencing other people, mm-hmm. and there's a social cost for that. You've got to be very, very careful, because very often, you know, it is an act of the powerful against the weak. The other thing is that there's a danger that if we try to soundproof ourselves, we're also engaged in a social soundproofing. We're not really listening to other people or to the world around us. We cut ourselves off socially from fellow human beings. So there are, even though it's a natural instinct to search for quiet, I think we have to be aware of the costs that sometimes come along with that.
So we are asking our listeners all this week how they block out noise in our day-to-day lives, what we do to create a quiet space. Do you think we've gotten noisier as a species over the course of 100,000 years? And with that, have we developed better techniques for doing what we need to do for ourselves to create that sense of quiet?
I think it's very difficult to argue that the world isn't noisier now than it used to be. Inevitably, there's more traffic, there's more machinery, more people, more of everything. So in that sense, objectively, we must be in some sense in a noisier world. Mm-hmm. But it hasn't been a smooth and continuous process. When motor cars were first introduced in the early 20th century, they were regarded as a blessing because they were going to be an improvement. They were going to be quieter than the clattering of iron-rimmed carts pulled by horses on cobbled streets, which were incredibly noisy. And in the 20th century, technology has helped make things quieter. The technology of soundproofing, of reducing engine noise and vibration. And also progressive social legislation, health and safety legislation about delivery times and the times of day that noisy activities can be conducted, or quiet zones around schools and hospitals. So there were great achievements in the 20th century through legislation that made, in some respects, cities especially, more tolerant, less disruptive places. So it's not a simple story, I think, of the world becoming ever noisier and a less pleasant place to live.
We've been speaking with David Hendy, the professor of media and communication at University of Sussex in England and creator of the 30-part BBC4 radio series Noise, A Human History. The companion book, Noise, A Human History of Sound and Listening, will be available here in the States this fall. You can find a link to David's series on our website, soundcheck.org. David, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Soundcheck. We're going to be airing an excerpt from David Hendy's radio series, Noise, A Human History, later this week on Soundcheck. But in the meantime, we want you to tell us how you block out noise in your daily life. What do you do? Where do you go to create a quiet space? Leave us a voicemail, 866-939-1612, or leave a comment on our website, soundcheck.org, or tweet us at Soundcheck. Up next, singer-songwriter Sam Beam, better known as Iron and Wine, joins us to play quiet acoustic versions of two new songs in our studio. But then later we will crank up the amps as we hear some music from Iggy and the Stooges live in New York this past Sunday, presented by Soundcheck and NPR Music. The desert put a babbler in your ear. We'll find your
stars are spinning to the wind now.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Iron and Wine have a new album out. It's called Ghost on Ghost, and it takes some cues from Motown, jazz, 1970s soul. Quite a departure from how we first met singer-songwriter Sam Beam 10 years ago when he first released some of his spare acoustic songs under the name Iron and Wine. Sam is going back to those roots here today, though, playing for us live solo on Soundcheck. Here is Iron and Wine, a.k.a. Sam Beam, with Winter Prayers.
Thanks, John. Well, it's cold and you're bored from counting the smart cars on 94. When you dream you're back home, but the lakeside don't trust you to walk alone. Hollow trees talk offhand, all the neckties are toasting with empty cans. And you know why she's gone, closing the river, drifting on. Slide down south, when once in a while your confidence leaves you like smoke falls out her red mouth. Mm. Oh. Backyard, December snow, but those sad souvenirs, they end at the fence line and they disappear. Why'd you follow her there? Milwaukee's a deaf ear for winter prayers. There's no night, there's no day, with only hope in your pocket and hell to pay. Slide down south, but once in a while your confidence leaves you like smoke falls out her red mouth.
From the new Iron and Wine record, Ghost on Ghost, that is a song called Winter Prayers, played live here in the Soundcheck studio by Iron and Wine's Sam Beam. Sam, welcome back.
Hey, John. It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
It's a big sound on this record, on Ghost on Ghost.
Yeah, it is. Lots of stuff going. Strings, horns.
Right. But here you are, just you and the guitar. Is this how these songs began?
It is, yeah. You know, they all start like that. I always start with the melody, you know, mm-hmm. just fooling around the guitar, the piano, and the melody, and then, you know, it depends on where you want to take it as far as how involved it gets in the production of it.
Well, it seems like you've wanted to take it further and further, you know, with this new record. You put together an amazing band.
Oh, got really lucky. So
of guys from here in New York.
Yeah, New Yorkers. We did it in Brooklyn. Like you said, we were talking earlier, Rob Berger helped me put the band together and did a lot of the arranging. So.
Rob is the keyboard player formerly of Tin Hat.
That's right, yeah.
And
with a lot of people around town.
Yeah. So, I mean, your last couple of records were made at home.
Yeah, for the most part. I did some tracking in Chicago, but everything else was developed at the house. The Shepherd's Dog record was all done at the house. And those records were really about learning how to discover what you were doing as you were going along and using the studio as an instrument. Whereas this one, but they took a long time. They took about the better part of a year, almost, you know, a little over 9 months, which I'm not complaining. I enjoy the work.
Yeah.
But it takes time to discover those things when you're working that way. Whereas this one, I wanted to do something a bit different and do a quote-unquote sophisticated record. And, you know, do the string sections and the horns, but it also meant you had to come in a bit more prepared with charts and things. You know, it was a bit more of a, instead of discovering a record, it was documenting this work, that this pre-production that we had done. So
right.
It was a lot different. But those guys were so talented. Honestly, I think we did it. We tracked the whole thing in like 2 weeks. It was amazing. Whereas the last one took 9 months. I walked out in two weeks with a record clicking my heels.
So you liked working this way?
I do. I mean, I like working the other way too, but this was definitely, you know, variety is the spice of life.
Also kind of old school, you know?
It was definitely old school. There's a track on there we were talking about earlier called Lover's Revolution, where it's all tracked live. You know, it was a kind of a Mingus tasting thing. And yeah, they got it in there. I think we did four takes and then they were done. And it was really smoking too. It's exhilarating to work like that. You know, it's a human quality to it that you don't get with the click track and
people putting in one part at a time.
I mean, there's definitely a benefit to those things too. But at the same time, this was really, really fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, the latest record is called Ghost on Ghost. Iron and Wine performing here in the New York area twice in the coming weeks. May 14th at the Beacon Theater here in New York. May 19th at the Capitol Theater just north of here in Portchester. Sam Beam playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio. Why don't we move right along? Another song from the new record. You want to do Low Light Buddy of Mine?
Sure. Yeah, let's do that one.
All right. Once again, Sam Beam, Iron and Wine, live on Soundcheck.
In a white car waiting for the light to change. He's a buddy of mine, but I can't complain. He can make a lot of money, he can touch his toes. He knows you never look till the lights are low. Cause I love you and you love me, so we never demand and we never agree. I love you and you love me, and there's new fruit humming in the old fruit trees. Jealous of me and what we got. He can buckle his belt, he can shine his shoe, but he can never end up where I found you. But I love you and you love me, so we don't talk back and we don't say please. In a white car waiting for the rain. the past. He's a buddy of mine, but that won't last. Cause he ain't the dumb grin on an empty cup we both took him for when he showed up. Cause I love you and you love me, so we both get stuck and we both get free.
That is Sam Beam of Iron and Wine, live, solo, acoustic, unplugged here in the Soundcheck studio. And boy, Sam, that is a very different song yeah. from what we get on the record with the full band. I didn't realize just how dark and kind of timeless. I mean, if it weren't for references to something like, you know, right. the light changing.
Right, right.
That sounds like it could have been written, you know, in Scotland yeah. or England in the 1700s or something.
right, and played in Memphis or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, well, you know, I like interpretation. You know, you write the song, but I treat it more like a script. You know what I mean? It should, if you've done your work, it should hold up to different interpretations. And honestly, that's really what's kind of fun. I know it's frustrating for people who, you know, want something familiar.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's really fun as a creative person to be able to take a script and reinterpret it and find the nuances and the subtleties that you can bring it, these subtle differences that you can bring out with you know, different interpretations.
Well, and that's kind of how the folk tradition has worked.
Yeah.
You know, nobody ever did an exact replica of right. the song as they learned it from whoever the itinerant right. person was that they learned it from.
Yeah, yeah. I think so. Yeah, there's definitely, you know, it's like anything. There's two different schools. You know, people want to learn how to do it precisely the way it's supposed to be, and there's people who want to learn it so they can interpret it in their way. And usually that's more fun to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, that song, Low Light Buddy of Mine, just, you know, it seems to be cut from the same cloth as old American songs like Pretty Polly.
And, yeah.
Except
yeah.
I don't think anyone's getting killed in your song. So that's
not,
nice.
Yeah, not maybe the fourth verse I left out.
So, Sam, going back to Twitter, our sister station, WQXR, the classical music uh-huh. station, allows one of its listeners to tweet from their account during Uh-oh. The course of the week. And this week's WQXR member listener tweets, "Want to hear the trapeze swinger," to which our producer Joel says, "Hey, this isn't a request show." On the other hand, we do happen to have the trapeze swinger, so we can wrap up with that.
Sure.
The new record is called Ghost on Ghost, and so it'll be full band at the Beacon Theater on May 14th, I assume?
Yeah, it's going to be, the big band. It's going to be fun.
And May 19th at the Capitol Theater in Port Chester. Sam, great to have you back with us on Soundcheck.
Always great to be here, John. Thanks so much.
And Halloween, making fools of all the neighbors, our faces painted. Forgotten one another, and when the morning came, I was ashamed.
If you like this segment with Iron and Wine, make sure to check out our website, because Sam Beam performed an extra song for us, plus we've posted a couple of videos that we shot during his visit. All of that's at soundcheck.org. In a moment, Nitsu Abubba of New York Magazine on a new exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Somewhat improbably, it's Punk, Chaos to Couture. And later, just Chaos, with excerpts from our recent live webcast with Iggy Pop and the Stooges. This is Soundcheck.
But much too high to see the empty road.
Yeah.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In recent weeks, we've covered a lot of music in New York's museums, from the blues at the Whitney to music videos at the Museum of the Moving Image. Now it's time to consider yet another exhibit that draws its inspiration from music, although this one might surprise you. The August Metropolitan Museum of Art has organized an exhibit called Punk, Chaos to Couture. It's an examination of punk's impact on high fashion. It opens on May 9th, but New York Magazine's Nisu Ababa is already considering what a punk fashion exhibit means for punk and Western civilization in general. Nisu, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
In your article, you say the memorializing of punk is right on schedule. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, for a long time, I guess the sort of like origin mythology of rock was this 60s narrative, the one you see in like that Julie Taymor film about the Beatles, where there's like people, teenagers excited by early rock and roll, and then maybe go to college and take psychedelic drugs and get involved in protest movements. And, you know, and then it ends somewhere at the end of the 60s, you know, Woodstock, then Altamont, whatever. And that's become, I think, really cozy and familiar to most people. It's like talking about the big band era, or, you know, it's just right. it's been absorbed fully.
Right.
So I think things have shifted forward where maybe you have more people's romantic images attached to this moment in the late 70s, which would be another sort of transfiguring rock moment where something seems to have changed and people can. A lot of people who are into, you know, independent and sort of alternative rock in particular might see that as sort of a breaking point, and that's where history begins, and before that is prehistory in some kind of way. So, yeah, I mean, over the past 10 years, it seems like there's been more and more focus on seeing rock in those terms, like rock as a niche interest that sort of started that.
And perhaps as a transgressive one, I mean, you know, you think of some of the anthems of the punk movement, you know, God Save the Queen, this snarling, sarcastic song from Johnny Rotten and the Sex Pistols. I mean, this really was sort of emblematic of what Nisu was talking about. Sex Pistols, God Save the Queen, the first flowering of punk in the UK. Nisu Ababa of the New York Magazine with me on Soundcheck, looking ahead to Punk, Chaos to Couture at the Metropolitan Museum next week. And Nisu, a couple of things about that Sex Pistols song. First of all, the idea that there's no future when punk has had an amazing future, you know, viewed from the vantage point of 1976-77.
Yeah. I mean, it's still a fairly vital part of the sort of lifeblood of, you know, independent rock music at this point. I mean, people still attach a lot of care and investment to the idea.
The other thing is, this is music that here in New York and then in London sort of grew up from grime and dirt and unemployment and a bleak, no future kind of vision. And so how does that get us into the world of fashion, of couture?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people who have strong ideological connections to punk would sort of don't like being reminded of this fact, but like it had a huge visual component and a sort of a fashion component. I mean, Malcolm McLaren and Vivienne Westwood, who was fairly instrumental in bringing an idea of punk to the UK. I mean, Westwood's a designer, and that was, I think, a big part of what they were doing. And that look seems to have maybe captivated more people more easily than the music even did. So, I mean, the idea behind the exhibit is to take a particular moment of that look, like right in the late 70s and its first flowering, and then trace the way that fashion designers in high fashion have picked pieces of it, because it did introduce a whole lot of new and interesting vocabulary to the way that people could look that they maybe hadn't looked before.
Uh-huh. So the spiky hair, the razor blades and safety pins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, metal hardware, like tattering, yeah. like tattered clothes in certain yeah. ways. And, yeah.
Although the safety pins, you know, that wasn't a fashion statement. That was a necessity, you know, for kids who were like wearing the same clothes over and over again because they didn't have a whole lot of choice.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And which is part of the, I mean, the romantic appeal of it, right? And I mean, we maybe act like people in high fashion are in such an opulent environment that they can't react to this. But I think, you know, somebody who's a designer will probably still take some pleasure in the idea of clothing with visual impact that was just made out of pure necessity and invention, you mm-hmm. know, not by other designers.
All right. So let me throw back at you a line from your article in New York Magazine. If a movement known for rage, rebellion, and adolescent id becomes the focus of a high fashion celebration, is it the final studded nail in the coffin or proof of everlasting life?
Yeah, that's the tagline on the article.
Yes, but now I'm asking you to answer your own question.
You know, I don't know that I have an answer for that. The one thing that I would say is that I think the idea of there's certainly a lot of rage and negativity and sort of sneering in punk, but I think maybe what is forgotten often is that, I mean, when you listen to it, it's fairly joyful music. The idea is sort of part of the impulse is like we can shred and throw away the things that we don't care for and then do anything we want. And when you listen, I mean, you don't listen to the Ramones and scowl and hate the world. You mm-hmm. listen to the Ramones and sort of jump around giddy and happy and enjoying the energy of it. And I think most punk has that positivity. A lot of good punk has that positivity to it as well. I think it's the inevitable point where, you know, the job of a museum is to look back on what happened in the world from its vantage point and say, you know, this is something that happened.
And continues to impact our lives today.
Yeah, although, I mean...
You hope that's what a museum is doing. That, you know, yeah. It's not just quote-unquote museum pieces, but that mm-hmm. they're still relevant somehow.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where it gets complicated, right? Because about a day after I finished writing this piece about a punk exhibit, you know, in the Met's Costume Institute, I walked around the corner from my house and saw, you know, a street full of hardcore kids coming out of a festival, the New York's All Right festival that was going on. So, you know, you're standing there on the street, realize, you know, there are hundreds of kids sort of gathered there who clearly care about punk as it's being practiced now, which is not, you know, versus a museum exhibit that's more interested in crystallizing it as this moment that happened in the past.
We're speaking with Nisa Abubba from New York Magazine. Nisa's article, you can find a link on our website, soundcheck.org, looking ahead to the Punk Chaos to Couture exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum, which opens on May 9th. To go back to the same singer, Johnny Rotten, with his later band, Public Image Limited, Pill, in the first single, Public Image, he starts with this line, "You never listen to a word that I say. You only see me for the clothes that I wear." So right there, still in the early years of punk, is this kind of statement that there's the music and then there's the look, and that maybe the one is not quite serving the other.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like anything that becomes a sort of massive national trend very quickly, the people who are originally involved in it are bound to be sort of annoyed by what they might view as superficial takes on it. Yeah. It's so tempting to kind of sneer at this exhibit because it seems so unpunk. But, I mean, you do kind of have to admit that the visual aspect of punk is a really powerful thing that really has grabbed people for a long time. So,
yeah. And when he was here on Soundcheck recently, Richard Hell, who was, you know, many people point to as the guy who invented or started that punk look. It was mm-hmm. necessity being the mother of invention in his case. Uh-huh. You know, he's apparently quite on board with this exhibit at the Met.
Yeah, I mean, I think he contributed a preface to the catalog, as did John Wyden.
But the idea that this whole this whole exhibit raises and that you wrestle with in your article is the idea of, you know, what does punk mean now in 2013? So you guys there at New York Magazine, you polled your readers. What kind of results did you get?
Funny results, generally. I mean, part of what I liked about doing that is that you get to see the sort of punk habit of, you know, if a glossy magazine calls to ask what punk is, that you're going to get some ironic and annoyed responses, which are really great to have in there, I think.
You might think the real punks just wouldn't even bother answering, but what did you get?
Perhaps, I don't know. Yeah, I think the first question, besides like age and gender, is what punk is, like a type of music, a political act, a lifestyle, a state of mind, a way of dressing. And there's a variety of answers on that. I guess there's 50% saying it's a lifestyle. But beyond that, a whole lot of different answers. A lot of people feel that punk has been co-opted. That's one of the yes-no questions. Mm-hmm. And when asked by whom, somebody, some great person responds by New York Magazine at the moment, which I think is terrific.
And who was the top punk band in the New York Magazine poll?
Greatest punk band of all time, as from these 100 respondents, was the Ramones, which is, I think, unsurprising given their sort of longevity and their role as a sort of long-running ideal of what, you know, what any punk band might sound like.
And let's not forget that they too had a look, you know, a very intended look. You know, it was not an accident.
Yeah, I think that's the longest running look in all of punk, right? Like through the end of the 90s, you walk into a record store and there's going to be somebody in there who looked exactly like, you know, in a rock record store who looked like a Ramon.
It was four guys who looked like the leader of the pack, you know, like that early 60s song, which of course was a style of music they referenced constantly in their version of punk. Mm-hmm. So, all right. So, not surprising then that New York Magazine's poll of its readers presents us with the Ramones as punk's top band, and punk's contributions to the world of high fashion on display at the Metropolitan Museum, opening on May 9th. Nisu Ababa's article for New York Magazine, you can check it out on our website, soundcheck.org. And Nisu, thanks very much for being with us.
No problem. Thanks for asking me.
Well, there is one bit of punk that I can almost guarantee you will have no impact on the Metropolitan's fashion exhibit. Iggy Pop has teamed up with his old band, The Stooges, and this past weekend, Soundcheck teamed up with NPR Music to present Iggy and The Stooges at Le Poisson Rouge, the nightclub here in Lower Manhattan, and it had all the hallmarks of a Stooges concert. Iggy wore no shirt, there was a lot of loud music, there was a lot of swearing, and I mean a lot of swearing. You can watch video of the whole uncensored thing on our website, soundcheck.org, but today we'll give you the family-friendly version, as family-friendly as Iggy Pop can be. Live at Le Poisson Rouge this past Sunday, here's Iggy and the Stooges and a track from their new album. It's called The Departed.
Soon grow cold, and tears come. no one here but us. By the end of the day, we all get thrown under the bus. I can't feel nothing real. My lights are all burned out. I can't feel nothing real. So what is the point of friendship? It's nobody's fault, but this nightlife is just a death trip. You're getting a steal, but in the light of day, everything's a dirty deal. And yesterday's a door that's open. So where is the life we started? The very talented James Williamson on slide guitar. Yes. So that really concludes the sex and death portion of the lyrical. Oh, that's nice. Smoochy smooch.
Iggy and the Stooges recorded live at Le Poisson Rouge this past Sunday in a song called The Departed, although you could hear Iggy Pop sort of teasing the audience by pretending he was going to launch into his old favorite, I Want to Be Your Dog. Never quite got there, but we did hear some other old classics from Iggy and the Stooges, including this one, Raw Power from 1973. Raw Power!
Showing a couple of
Iggy and the Stooges, Iggy Pop and the Reunited Band performing the title track from their 1973 album, Raw Power, and performing it live this past Sunday afternoon at a special public radio event at Le Poisson Rouge here in Lower Manhattan. You might have seen the live webcast online, and if you didn't or did and want to see it again, the video is up on our website at soundcheck.org. Thanks to Iggy and the Stooges and to our friends at NPR Music for a great show. Tomorrow on Soundcheck, former Gossip Girl star Penn Badgley on the challenge of portraying the late musician Jeff Buckley in the new film Greetings from Tim Buckley. Also, trumpeter and composer Wadada Leo Smith talks about 10 Freedom Summers, his epic jazz piece inspired by moments in the civil rights struggle. And singer-songwriter John Grant performs some tunes from his new album, Pale Green Ghosts. We're going to leave you with one more song from Iggy and the Stooges, and it's another old favorite, Funhouse, recorded Sunday afternoon at Le Poisson Rouge. That's going to do it for tonight's show. I'm John Schaefer. Hope you'll be back with us again tomorrow night at 9. This is Soundcheck.